open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
The nature of the profession is that we try to be a truth teller. We try to be good citizens. We try to be adults.
Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Today, poet Nikki Giovanni talks about the importance of telling the stories of everyday people.
I know that the easiest thing to think is that our lives are insignificant or I'm not a writer. And you have to realize that your grandchildren, not to mention your great-grandchildren, have no idea of the life that you and I have led.
Nikki Giovanni is the author of many collections of poetry, as well as works of nonfiction and children's literature. Giovanni's creative output spans more than 40 years and expresses her strong racial pride and respect for family. Her latest book, Chasing Utopia, is a highly personal combination of poetry and memoir. Our host today is books editor at O Magazine, Lee Haber. Giovanni starts off our program telling Haber about the Harlem neighborhood she lived in as a young adult in the late 1960s. Her neighbors included a number of now well-known cultural luminaries, including the actor Morgan Freeman.
I live in a great neighborhood. Morgan was next door. Cornell Dupree lived downstairs. Eugene McDaniel was a half a block over. Sidney Poitier was a good friend of McKell's, and that was on the corner there. I mean, it was an incredible, Adrian Rich.
Wow.
Came to our same cleaners. It was an incredible thing. But I was going to California for something. I had a 1960 Volkswagen, paid $600 for it. And that was when that was real money. You know, today it would be a steal. And Morgan was working at the DMZ in the village, Demilitarized Zone. He was doing poetry in the village, right? And so he said to me, well, since you're going to California, can I use your car? And I was like, sure, you know, take the car. Well, he got a call from New Haven to come up and audition for a show. And, you know, actors are they're sweet and stuff, but they're very focused. And so...
on themselves.
You know what I'm saying? Right. And so Morgan, you know, just parked the car and went on up to New Haven. He got the job. So I'm in California. He's in New Haven. The car, you know, in New York is offside parking. So after a couple of tickets, they towed it away. So when I came back, the car wasn't there. And I was like, Morgan, where's the car? And he said, I don't know. I said, Morgan, I left you the car. He said, you know, it was towed away, which it was. But getting it out of tow was more expensive than buying a new one. So
I believe that.
And I got to tell you, because you all don't really know me, it's my first time here, but I'm a nice person. And I am. And so I was very calm. Morgan had a wife. Well, he had actually an ex-wife and a wife and a couple of kids, because, you know, he went on to have a lot of kids. And I said, I'm not going to bother him. One day, if he does well, he'll do the right thing, right? Well, I saw Morgan, because it goes on and on. I ran into him in California a couple of years ago, and he was there with his friends and all of the actors and everything. And I was like, hi, Morgan, remember me? And so everybody looks, and, you know, it's like really nice. Like, you owe me a car. And I don't want a Volkswagen now. I want a Jaguar.
Still waiting for that one, right?
Well, I lobby his grandchildren because I run and say, your granddaddy owes me a car. And so the granddaddy, you owe Nikki a car. And that's, I want to send that guilt.
Now, you probably don't realize, unless you've read the book already, that Chasing Utopia may have something to do with beer, the title Chasing Utopia.
It is a beer. Well, see, Mommy, every day that I knew her, and as her daughter, drank a beer. And, of course, Mommy had regular blood pressure. I will wake up in the morning. And the first thing I have to do is take a blood pressure pill, which is the Giovanni side of the family. They all are excitable and we all have things. Mommy had perfect blood pressure. Mommy had, she didn't have to wear glasses. She had all of her teeth, right? None of which is true of either one of her daughters. Gary and I both wear glasses. We can't half see, and I can't hear anymore. You know, so, you know, I mean, it's an amazing thing. So she was healthy. I know it had to do with the fact that every day she drank a beer because beer is a liquid. I'm a coffee drinker, and it's not a liquid, you know. And then when I got old, it's not. I mean, you know that. And as I got older, I became a wine drinker, which is not a liquid. So we knew that Mommy was that's true. But we knew that Mommy wasn't doing well the first time. She was kind of sitting up, and I said, would you like a beer? She drank Bud Light. I said, would you like a beer? And she said, no. And then it hit me, Mommy's dying. You know, because she never did not want a beer. Well, I was sad because my sister had cancer. Mommy died in June. She died on June 24th. My sister Gary died on August the 10th. my Aunt Ann died because Ann did everything that Mommy did. And so that's the truth. You'd have to know the family. But I'm sure that Ann just said, oh, you know, Yolen's dead, so we're dying now. And she died in October, you know. And I was a friend of Rosa Parks, and Rosa died at the end of October. So all of a sudden I went from being a baby in the family
right.
to being the adult, to being responsible. So I had things to do.
And Coretta Scott King.
Coretta and I weren't that close, but Coretta did die, and that was sad. But Rosa hurt me because she was a friend. She was.
Since most of us in this room probably never met Rosa Parks, what was that like?
Oh. Sam, I've got all. I have to start. It must be my age that makes me tell stories. I'm Southern, but I was recently. That's true. Let me answer this way. I was recently in Ghana, and I was in Accra with Queen Juanita, who is a wonderful old woman. I have this weakness for old ladies, and it was just wonderful being with her. But when you're with a queen, people try to tell you how to behave. And so people were saying to me, now, you know, Queen Juanita is a queen, and we do this, and we do this. And I said, wait, well, first of all, let me share. Queen Elizabeth II of England asked to meet me, and I agreed to do that, and I have met Queen Elizabeth II. But more, I was a friend of Rosa Parks. If I don't know how to treat a queen, I don't know who does.
Wow.
That's what being in her presence, you know, and she's like any other old lady. It's true. If she doesn't, I mean, that's Queen Elizabeth and the rest of me talking to them. What they don't want you to know, they're not going to tell you, so you know, there's no point in asking.
Right.
And I do know that. You know, you never ask any of those kind of people. I don't ask Toni Morrison anything. I don't ask Maya, and we're all friends. If they want me to know, they will tell me. If they don't mention it, it's none of my business. And I just sit there and wait and drink. Well, with Maya, I drink, which is a bad idea. No, Maya will drink you under the table.
Now, Nikki, so the book is called Chasing Utopia, and the subtitle under
it. I have to call her now. You know I have to call her. I don't know what I was talking about.
It's called Poems. But not all of the pieces in the book are poems. It's very memoirish. So what's the definition in your mind of a poem?
Oh, gosh. I do. A poem is the truth. Is telling the truth. But can I finish so that they'll not think I'm crazy? One of the, getting back to utopia, there was nobody to do anything but me. And I'm now the oldest because Anne has a daughter, but she's way younger. So we had things to do, and I am responsible. That's what I'm. But after we got everything done, I was incredibly sad. And I'm a fan of sadness, by the way. So now if you're sad, hell, be sad. You know, all of that, be strong and stuff. I got done what I was supposed to, but then I was sitting on the deck, and I just over-drinking, that's a fact. So I started the morning, because I'm, you know, I lost everything that meant something to me at that point. And so I started the morning with Chardonnay, and then I'd move into a nice, you know, Malbec, or, you know. And so by 4 o'clock, my dog is being embarrassed. You know, no, I mean, Alex
was
is looking at me like, you have to stop drinking, Nikki. And so it went on for a while because I was sad, and I thought, well, I'm going to be sad, and then eventually I'll wake up one day, and I'll still be sad, but it'll be time to move on. And so I thought, well, finally it's time to move on. But there was something that I needed that was left over, and I thought, what do I need to do to complete this thing with my mother? And you can't, I'm a mama's girl, so I won't live long enough to get over it. But I thought, Mommy drank a beer every day, so I should drink a beer. I don't like beer. And I never was a beer drinker. I cook with it, and I do. You know, it's really good with your short ribs or your pig feet, you know, your chitlins, put a, you know, bottle of, yeah, really. Or right now, the pumpkin ales are out, so if, you know, you're making, you know, it's really great for things like that, but don't drink that stuff. So I thought, if I'm going to drink it, I should drink the best, right? And so I went to B&N, and I got, you know, the beer book, and the number one beer in the world is Utopia. And it's a Sam Adams beer. And it costs $350 a pint. So I called, it's not for everybody. That's the truth. But
did you like beer after that?
I haven't drunk it. But I called to get it, and my wine guy, my wine and beer guy, I live in a university town. Said, we never get it. And I called Bounty Hunter. You probably know Bounty Hunter. Out in California, they sell everything. And we don't sell it because it's a beer. They gave me the Canadian website that I could pick it up, but one thing led to another, and that didn't work out. But and you guys may not know it, because I'm having the impression that I'm probably having mostly a white audience. But if anytime, I mean, no disrespect, but every time something strange happens to you and you're black, everybody black knows when. I got a call from the CIA, so everybody in the audience black knows, oh, it was February. Because they're not going to call you any other time. And so I thought, I need to go speak. They invited me to speak, and it was like, yeah, I'm a citizen, I'm going to speak anyway. But I thought, they can find Utopia, because they can find the CIA. So Leah,
so you chased it, you found it.
Well, more or less, but you know, men treat women badly at times. They don't mean to. But I asked the director. No, I mean, this wasn't like mean, just, you know, the way men treat women. And so I asked the director, I said, you know, I'm looking for Utopia. Do you think you can help me? And he did one of those, you know, pat you on the shoulder. Look deep inside yourself. I'm sure you'll find it. It's like, no, Leon. And so we went on. They took me to dinner, and the associate director was there. And I said to him, you know, I'm trying to find a utopia. You think you can help me? He said, I'm sure that if you just take the time. You know? And I was like, I need somebody black. So I finally did. I found this black guy, and I was like, you know, I'm trying to get utopia. He said, wait a minute, I can find it for you. He said, we got to get a safe computer. And so we went into a room. I couldn't look, and he looked at, and he found it. He said, this is where it is. He's not allowed, of course, just so everybody who pays taxes knows. He's not allowed to buy beer or anything like that for me, but he showed me where to get it. So by this time, though, I'm bitching all the way, you know, because I'm on book tour and I'm upset about it. And I happen to be in Boston bitching about not being able to find Utopia, and I'm in Boston at Sam Adams. And the phone in the studio rang, and it's the guy who makes Utopia. Right. He said, tell Dr. Giovanni we are sending it down and the glass to drink it out of. So that was really nice of him. So I haven't drunk it yet because my book just came out on Tuesday.
Yeah, it's great. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
So there are poems in it, but it's also, there's a memoir element, there are reflections. So back to the idea of what, you know, how did you decide what to include in this and what's a poem?
I don't really know it's a conscious thing like that. I think as a writer, it's more like what I won't include. Mm-hmm. And I'm really picky about whose story. And so one of the things I wanted to share with the audience, because I know some of us in this audience are older, and I know that the easiest thing to think is that our lives are insignificant or I'm not a writer. And you have to realize that your grandchildren, not to mention your great-grandchildren, have no idea of the life that you and I have led. That my granddaughter, who is 8, does not know a landline. And so if I talk to her about, in the old days, the phone had a line on it, Kai is like, really, grandmother? Because she's used to iPhone. And what did your phone do in your day? Because you know how they're always doing you your day. What did your phones do in your day? Could you look at movies? Are you kidding? I had a party line. I couldn't even talk. And we all have these sort of stories. Our kids don't know trains because they haven't had an opportunity to go across country on a train. And I'm really sorry they're no longer doing supersonic transport, but you start to think about the things that the kids don't know that we did, that this is what we had to do. Some of us walked to school, and that was a shock to them.
Right.
You mean Daddy didn't drop you off? You know, I mean, you know. And it's really amazing. So I'm always encouraging, especially the older generation, and if you're retired particularly, join a writing group.
Yeah.
Because even though you say to yourself, oh, I'm not going to get a bestseller or whatever, you have a story to tell, because one day, if you don't tell your story, who will? And a part of that story is that you fell in love, a part of it is that it didn't work, and you got a divorce, or you hated your, whatever it is, it doesn't matter what it is, it's your story. And it should be put down so that as we go on, when we think about 21, I mean, who would have thought that we would even see 2000?
Right.
And when you think about 21, 21 is only, what, 90 years away? Not quite.
Won't see it.
Many of us won't. But we have people that we're kin to who will. And they need to know what we saw in 2000. But we also, I am connected. My grandmother was born in 1895. But her mother was the free child of slave parents. We called her Mama Dear. Now, I knew Mama Dear. My mother and I argued about that because Mama Dear died when I was 4, and she said, Nikki, you cannot remember Mama Dear, but I do. And I won't even let my mother take my memories away from her. I remember because Mama Dear did peppermint, and she had a big, she loved it. She had a big barber pole.
What do you mean she did peppermint?
She ate it. I mean.
Right. Okay.
She ate it. And she had a little cobbler's hammer.
Right.
And I don't know why Mama Dear and Grandpapa both liked me. I really don't. I've begun exploring this. If there's another book, a part of it will be the exploration of that. But both of them liked me. And I think it's because of the grandchildren. I was a grandchild that didn't do anything. My sister was incredibly talented, and she could play the piano, and she sang, and she had dimples, and she was beautiful. And my cousins were boys, and they did boy things, and everybody was excited about that. And then there was Nikki. And I was just the kid in the corner always watching. And it was, I don't know, I think in many respects I probably led a lonely existence. You know, it doesn't bother me.
At that point, did you start, at what point did you start writing?
I didn't start writing until I was in high school, you know, because I enjoyed
storytelling. So you were just storing up those thoughts. And
yeah, just watching stuff. But Mama Dear would say, she called me Youngin. Come here, Youngin, and I remember that so well. And she would take me, she kept her trunk, she didn't trust people. And she kept her trunk in her bedroom. And we had what was called a back porch. Anybody that's Southern knows a back porch. Mm-hmm. And everybody else's luggage is out on the back porch, but Mama Dear kept hers. And I remembered so well. I'm 4 years old when she died. And we would go in, I would follow her, and she would open up her trunk, and she had a barber pole. And you know, I don't know if you know mm-hmm. the book.
Yeah.
And she would chip a piece off. And she, wow. she treated me like I was, you know, a puppy or something. She put it in my mouth. And I remember that so well.
Do you want to read anything from the book about your grandparents?
I can't read about Mama Dear because those, I was just sharing that. But I've been kind of working on, my father was an idiot, by the way. And he was. And I didn't write about Gus. We called him Gus. I didn't write about Gus because I had enough sense to know when I was younger, I was so angry with him that if I had written something, I would have made a judgment. And I wasn't old enough to make a judgment because it wasn't my story, if that makes sense. And so the craziness that he brought, he also loved. There's a writer, and I love her so much. She's such an incredible young woman, Edwidge Dedekind.
Oh, Dante.
And Edwidge wrote, I think one of the best, I think Edwidge is going to be the next American Nobelist, she should be.
She's amazing.
And she wrote The Dewbreaker. Mm-hmm. And The Dewbreaker, if you haven't read it, is an incredible book, but it's about a man who tortures. And if any of you are Scandal fans, you know that it's incredible. Mm-hmm. And her father tortures. Now, her father also played the brother from another planet. Mm-hmm. So I have a bet going with a friend of mine that they're going to have to redeem this man because we cannot have the brother from another planet being a mean man. So there has to be something. He's a great guy. But this, too, helped me understand. My father didn't mean to be crazy. He just was. And it was the way that he loved us. He wasn't sick. He could hold a job and things like that. But there were these angers, and it would explode. And so there was nobody for it to explode on but us. I was 70. I mean, I'm writing this. I must have written this when I was 69, because this was new poem. And I realized that, again, I didn't want to make a judgment. First of all, it wasn't mine to make. It was my mother. It was his to write. It was my mother's judgment to make. My next person to say something about it would have been my sister, but they're all gone, so it now has become my story. Chocolate cookies, chocolate cakes, chocolate fudges, chocolate lakes, chocolate kisses, chocolate hugs, two little chocolate girls in a chocolate rug. No one can find us, we're all alone. Two little chocolate girls running from home. Chocolate chickens, chocolate bunnies, chocolate smiles from chocolate mommies. Chocolate rabbits, chocolate snakes, two little chocolate girls wide awake. What an adventure, my, what fun. Me and my sister still on the run, still on the run, still on the run. Me and my sister still on the run.
Oh, that's beautiful.
I've been telling myself I quit crying when I read that. But and I do, I realize my father did not mean to do, he meant to do what he did, but he didn't mean it to come out the way that it came out. Does that make sense?
You mentioned that he was an alcoholic, right?
Oh, he was an alcoholic, yes. And I didn't have my first drink until after I had cancer. That's the truth. All of my life, I never drank. Well, that's probably one reason I don't drink beer. But after I had cancer, I said, if I'm not dead, I may as well have. I did. I had my first, and I said, I'm going to do it. Because I collected wines, because I collect art, and I collect things. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if there are any wine people in the room, but I had the occasion to buy a case of 48 Richebourg. Yeah. So I bought it as an investment because I knew I had a son and I knew he had to go to college, and I thought, I'll sell that for $10,000 and never look back. And then I thought, or I could drink it. So my sister and I drank it.
I just heard today that there's actually a short supply of wine, in the world, that they're underproducing wine, and maybe it's because you're drinking it too fast.
No. I think it's because the price fell.
Right, right.
And I was down in Argentina, and of course they're making incredible Malbecs. And I think that Europe, unless Europe has another big war, and I hate to say it like this, but the war really did help the grapes. Right. And so if we're willing to kill another couple of million people, we could probably get a vintage. I think it's probably pushing it just to have a good bottle of wine, you know what I'm saying?
So. Well, since you said that, one of the things that really makes you so extraordinary, in addition to how beautiful the poetry is, and is that you really are known to be political, an activist. How much of being a poet is about being an activist?
I think you have to care about something. And I had the really marvelous occasion, I think it's 3 years ago now, 4 years ago, I'm really losing track of time, to read with Seamus Heaney. Mm-hmm. And it was really incredible because to have the two of us on stage together was a lot of fun. Seamus is such a great guy. And again, he's political. I mean, people to say, I'm not political, is to say you don't care about the world. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean I'm running for office or trying to get anybody reelected. I don't, campaign and stuff like that. I do complain sometimes because I'm unhappy about, the shutdown was ridiculous. Mm-hmm. How do grown people not come to some conclusion and we settle this?
But I think sometimes when people hear the word poetry, they think of something very sober or something very intense, or something that is in a way detached from the world, and you've always been someone who is inextricable from, participating in the world and really being of it. So
I think it's true of all of them. I mean, that's why Shakespeare said, first we kill the poets and the lawyers, if you recall. No, I think we've always, the nature of the profession is that we try to be a truth teller, and we are not trying to run for office. I mean, I don't know when the last time, what's his name in Yugoslavia, the poet.
Oh, yeah.
But we don't. We just try to be good citizens. We try to be adults. And we try to pass along good tidings, but good tidings are not everything is going to be all right. This is not reggae. What is that boy that, don't worry, be happy. No,
right.
If you're not worried today, you don't know what's going on. we've got to be. And I'm a big fan of America. I think that it's an interesting country, and I think it's a good idea, and I think that we need to, get this idea moving along. And I think that a lot of times people forget, people want to be afraid of something. They want to be afraid of the old are sucking up our resources, or the young are not doing this, or the blacks are not, mm-hmm. doing their fair share, or we have too many foreigners, as if the whole damn nation isn't a foreign nation. So, it's so ugly. And I think unworthy of us. And when we look at the world, I'm a big fan of water. So being up here, we were looking today. I know that the water situation on Earth is an international problem. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of Prince Charles because I like his environmental stance and I like what he's trying to do about water. We know we have to do, it's a international thing about air. We have to do that. But transportation is an international mm-hmm. Situation. We have to solve that. Why do I have to fly all over the world to get to Traverse City? I should be able to get on Calm Air in Cincinnati and fly right up here.
Right.
But I should.
Yeah.
Or better yet, there should be a solar train.
There you go. Yeah.
That takes me right up. Yeah.
So what What's your writing process like? I mean, when you sit down to write, what sparks your ideas for writing poetry? And do you just, do you run to the computer and do you, or do you write longhand?
No, I do write on the computer. I'm smiling because Joe Heller, who was a friend and I think a great loss, Catch-22.
Oh, Catch-22.
Is just, but Joe was such a great guy to always have a glass of wine with. He was just, you know, a great guy. And Joe always said, I always have the last line. And I was just, you know, talk to him, because he was the big writer and I'm the poet, you know, so there's no. And he would, you know, Joe, what do you, I always, he said, know my last line. Well, I almost pretty much always know my first.
Wow.
And so I'll have something in my head and I'll say, oh, I wonder where it's going.
What's an example of that in the book?
Ooh, I don't know.
Well, what about?
Well, the example would be a love poem, but.
Oh, read us one.
You want a love poem? I like that this is a, let me find it. No, I fell in love. And I, you know how, what's her name? Bonnie Raitt.
Raitt.
Yeah,
Raitt.
Nick of Time is Raitt. One of my favorite records.
You love that.
I found love, baby, just in the nick of time. And, you know, because you're busy and my life got turned upside down. I had a lot of things to do. And then, you know, you see somebody and you think, oh, isn't he cute? And there you do. And I laugh because everybody's married at my age, so you know you have to go through, you know, looking for somebody single, you won't find anybody. So, well, you know, we can share. But doesn't hurt.
So, what are you going to read?
I'm going to read Still Life with Apron. I would like to see you cooking. I would like for you to cook for me. I would like to see you decide upon a menu. Go to the market and pick the fruit, the vegetables, the fish. I would like to see you smell the fish, test the fish for firmness and freshness. I would like to watch you in the bakery by the dinner rolls, deciding, rolls or crusty bread. I would watch you run back to get the goat butter. I would like to be sitting in a corner and you, intent upon your meal, not noticing me. When you go to the wine store, I would watch you wrestle with red or white. White, of course, because it's fish, but red is seductive. Whoever fell in love over a glass of white wine? I, uncharacteristically on time, would like you to greet me in a butcher's apron. I would like to watch you greet me only in an apron.
I love that.
You would ask me to undress for you, before I sit down at the beautiful table. Before you hand me my glass, you would ask me to undress. I would like to watch you watch me undressing for you. I would like to watch the movement inside the apron as I undress for you. I would like to watch you walk, no, stroll to your closet where you bring out your old buffalo plaid dressing gown, your pilly, much-washed dressing gown that smells like you. After you brush your teeth, after you shower, after you comb your hair, I would like to embrace your odor, your essence as we sit down to eat. I would like for you to cook for me. I would like that very much.
Wow, love that. So, when was that poem written?
Recently.
Recently. And did you have someone in mind?
Yeah, I have someone, yes.
Okay. Yeah. So, you had the first line in mind, and then...
Well, I wanted him to cook for me.
What? And did he?
Well, that gets to be my story.
Okay.
But I did. I just, I know he cooks, and I realized I had a poem.
Oh.
You always do that. That's the bad thing about poets. You know, we do these things, then it's like, that would be a really good poem. So, you know, you didn't particularly want his wife to read it, but she...
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up in the second half, Nikki Giovanni talks about the terrible day when a mass shooting occurred at the university where she teaches, Virginia Tech.
Unseen hand guiding me on a path to believe in tomorrow, challenge to trust, determined to live the vision of yesterday's dream.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. We return now to Lee Haber's conversation with poet Nikki Giovanni, whose latest book is called Chasing Utopia.
Now, Virginia Tech, which you love,
I do.
Had in 2007 had terrible thing happen, and you actually had the shooter in your class, and then afterwards you were asked to give a convocation. So, can you tell us a little bit about what that felt like?
And I was in Los Angeles the night before. I'm never on campus on Monday, by the way. I taught Mr. Cho, and I did put him out of my class because he was not he wasn't going to be taught by me. He was not cooperating, and it just wasn't working. And I don't have ego like that. And so I went to my department head, Lucinda Roy at that time, and I said to Lucinda, you know, he's got to go. This doesn't work. And she said, well, you know, we're here to teach. I said, well, Lucinda, we put it another way. Either you take Mr. Cho out of my class or on Thursday, because that was a Tuesday, the next thing that'll be on your desk on Thursday will be my resignation. I'm not going to walk into the classroom with this young man anymore. I found him to be evil. I've said that. I've been consistent in that. I don't think he was crazy. I think he was evil. And if you've ever felt if you've ever been in a position to feel something is evil, you have an idea. But that was 2 years before, you know, the shooting. I was in California when the night before, and it was one of those something tells me. And something said, you need to go home. And so we started flying home, but it was a windy day. And when we got to Charlotte, we couldn't get up because the winds were too bad. So we got to Charlotte, I don't mean it like that. But the LA, the overnight gets into Charlotte at 6 o'clock. Right. So you can take the 7:15 and you're home. But we couldn't get out. And so we're now being held in Charlotte just trying to get home. So nobody knew, because you don't get information in an airport. And so nobody knew. And we flew up. We finally just got, you know, it was like, let's go. And the people that were going up to Blacksburg jumped on the plane. I was sitting, and I'll never forget that, I was sitting in 13. And as we landed, you know, the kids all have those things, cell phones.
Right.
And one of the young ladies, she was sitting about 11, said, oh, my God, there's been a shooting. And at that point, she said, 12 people have been shot. And everybody on the plane that was grown, all of us, said, no, sweetheart, it must be one or two. There was some mistake. And by the time we walked, coming across that plane doesn't connect. It's an old-fashioned. And so coming across the tarmac, you know, the wind was that strong. You know, we couldn't get helicopters up. It's one of the reasons that we lost some people, because we couldn't put a helicopter in the air. And we had to transport people. And that was incredibly sad. But we finally got in. When we got into the station, of course, at that point, CNN was on, you know, the TVs were on, and it was 21, and then it started going up. Normally, I go home on Smart Bus because it costs a dollar. I'm not cheap, but that's, and it's right there, and I walk out. It's a mile from my house, so I get to walk home. And I ran down, and it was like, I need to be home. And so I ran and got one of the last rental cars, because at that point, everything was coming in. So I had, a Honda, something that you would never drive, because it was like chugging along, you know what I'm saying? And I really wanted to be home. And WDBJ shot by me, and that's our locals, and it just went shoo. And I was like, oh, this is really, really bad. And I was trying to get, I have Sirius radio, so I'm used to being able to, you know, I could have punched in, you know, 122, and I got, but now I'm on an AM station, right? And I couldn't get VTU. I couldn't get us. I couldn't get Radford. So I don't know if anybody's ever been in a coup, but it felt like a coup. It felt like, you know, something is right. And I kept turning down, and I finally got, it's called ROCK, R-O-C-K, ROCK of Virginia. And they had someone in the hall on the radio, and that's how the information was coming. So, you know it was really bad. When I don't actually live in Blacksburg. Well, when I got to the Blacksburg turnoff, the police had already stopped it, so you could not, nothing was going into Blacksburg. So I went on home, and I have 5 televisions, so they all went on different stations. Of course, my phone, we have 3 lines that come into the house, and so my phone was ringing. And, you know, just picking up the phone. It was a terrible, terrible thing. And it was one of those, and I just said to myself, I called my friend John Bryant, whom you have no reason to know, but John called, he lives in Cincinnati, and he said, are you okay? I said, John, I know who's doing this. I really do. And he said, you know, you should be careful what you say. I said, no, I shouldn't be careful what I say. I know who's doing this. And it turned out it was Mr. Cho. I mean, he just knew it. And so, you know, now we're on the phone. You know, newspaper people are crazy. And so they are coming to my home. And I don't, we won't even go into how do they know where you live. And the dog is going crazy. And people are in your bushes, you know, knocking on your door and things like that. And they want to, I didn't know enough to talk to them. But the phone rang about 7:30, something like that, and it was Sandy Smith, who was Dr. Steger's secretary. She said, Nikki, we need you to anchor convocation. And of course, the answer to that is yes. You know.
And so what did you say, or what message did you think needed to be communicated?
I thought we needed to be reminded who we are. And I was upset for a lot of reasons. And one of the reasons that a kid I loved an awful lot got killed, and faculty members that I knew, and It was very sad, and so I knew that I could not stand on stage and do what I'm now doing. I knew I had to write it,
right.
And I'm pretty good on my feet. I mean, you've been talking. I know what I think, but I just didn't want to take a chance on standing in front of Virginia Tech and breaking down. So I wrote it, but it's still a very sad moment for us. I didn't realize, thank God, that I was on an international hookup. And when I got home, a friend of mine called me from Japan. And I was like, oh, my God, how did that happen? You know, if I had known I was on the internet, I probably would have, you know, and George Bush was there.
You know.
And Laura and them. And, you know, I've known important people. So I wasn't trying to address the president either, because I thought if I get involved in anything, it'll be ugly.
Right.
I, you know, because I'm not a Bush person.
Well,
so, you know, I'm not.
But about that event, and I can't remember whether I read it or I heard you say it, but, you know, you talk about how killing is the opposite of the act of creation, obviously.
It is.
You know, but you were so eloquent on that point.
Not just that we are Virginia. I mean, what I wanted to convey and what I wanted to share, and as I said, I was speaking for Virginia Tech. I mean, this is a school I love, and these were people that I know. This is not, we are not who is dead, and we are not who is killing. We are the people that have to go forward, and we are sad. I mean, that was a line of all of the poems that I've done, and I don't remember a lot of my line. We are sad today, and we are going to be sad. And people like me are, I mean, you see, I mean, it's been a year, and I didn't know you were going to ask me about it, but I've probably asked you not to. But it's not something you get over.
Right.
And of course, the kids that are with us now don't know it.
Right.
And so the kids that are with us now go on, and our job is to be strong and go on for them. But even if we're talking about it with them, I don't cry all the time, but there are a couple of things that make me cry. And my father's craziness and the death of Virginia Tech is another one. You know, these are just, it happens. Hell, people cry, so, you know, you get over it. It does.
Well, you've talked about being 70, 71, and it being really the best time of your life in some ways. And I just love how you talk about that. So can you tell us a little bit about how you're...
Growing old is a really good idea. And one of my favorite... it is. One of my very favorite birthday cards, and I give it a lot, so I've probably given it to people that I've given it to before, but they don't want to tell me. But it's... It says, you know, on the outside, it says, birthdays are good for you. And when you open it up, it says, statistics show that the people who have the most live the longest. I love it. I really love it. It's been fun. And one of the things that I like about Tech, too, because I think that when Tech recruited me, they didn't necessarily know what they were getting. And, I mean, they were like, we need a writer. And somebody said, well, why don't you try Giovanni? You know, but... I really like who we are, and I like how we've grown. And for me, it's so important. since I am there, one of the things that we know is that we have to get the kids to travel. Mm-hmm. And travel, and it doesn't mean you know what you're doing. One of the things I'm trying to do with the National Science Foundation right now is I want them to let me take six writers and two undergraduates to Antarctica. I went to Antarctica last year, and wow. It was just an incredible trip. My Aunt Agnes, who's the one who's left, Ag called me, and Ag was 89 when she called. And she said, you know, Nikki, I've been to every continent except Antarctica. Wow. I said, Ag, you're 89. If we don't go soon, you know, it won't be looking good. So it takes a year because you can only go down during December. Right. You're not, because it's frozen down there. We weren't red-shirted, so we're not, you know, down with the polar bears. And, you know, we're just going to be in the Falklands, and we're going to be able to walk on. And it was icy, you know. It's right. Cold but not freezing. We went out to the rookery, and she was afraid of that. She's like, it's 5 miles to the Penguin Rookery. I said, well, Ag, you know, if you don't make it, you'll either have a heart attack and freeze to death, or, you know, I'll pick you up and have your body taken back. You know, it'll be fine. So we always laugh. But it was a wonderful trip. And in dealing with the president of our university, of Virginia Tech, is an architect. And I really want him to go. Mm-hmm. Because we haven't had any writers in Antarctica at all. We have scientists and we've had photographers. So we need to send the writers down. We need the poets, the critics, the novelists, the children. So we need people to go. But we also could benefit, which he and I were just talking just before I came on this tour. And I'm saying to him, Dr. Steger, you have to go because we need the architects to go down to say, and what will we build in the future? Mm-hmm. We don't have any architects down there. What is the future going to look like on Antarctica? Because whatever we're going to find in Antarctica is what we're going to find in Mars. And we can't just keep putting those tents up there and temporarily saying it's okay. Right. And so we're having this discussion. My other part of my discussion, I laugh, with the National Science Foundation is, and we'll need 4 cases of wine. You just can't take writers down there without right. wine. So we get to stop.
Red know. Or white?
Yeah.
I know.
Red.
I
know. Real wine.
No one fell in love over
no,
or so fell you, in love over white wine.
It'll be, no, we really do. And, you know, we're just right there in Santiago. So that's easily yeah. enough. Send it down to the Falklands, and then we'll pick it up and take it over. So that in the evening, because that's what writers do. We're going to get up. Well, we're there at midnight sun, so it's no morning. But we'll be up at 6 o'clock because the scientists are up and out. We will find whoever it is we like because now, you know, NSF is the people with the beds. But we'll find people and we'll go out with them and we'll see what's there. The whales will not be at home, as you know, because they'll be up in California then. But we'll get to sort of see what it is that I don't know what we'll learn, but I know enough to know that you don't have to know everything in order to learn it. That was a bad sentence, wasn't it?
I work at a
research institution, so the research institutions always want to say, we want to find out how A equals B equals C, but we are the creative end of a research institution, and one of our greatest presidents has been a creator, because architecture is not a science, it's an art. Mm-hmm. And you hire the scientists. That's what you have the vision, and then you tell the guy who puts the plumbing in, he's the scientist, or who puts the electricity in. But you're the one that says, I want the building to be 120 stories high. That's a dream. You see what I'm saying? And so taking him as an artist and taking us as artists, and we sit, of course, Dr. Steger actually drinks scotch, so we'll take scotch for him. It's the first thing I learned about anybody is what they drink. Because that way you have something that you can talk to them about.
Right.
And if they have a dog.
And if you have a dog.
I have a dog. Everybody I know, we're all dog people. I have one friend who's a cat person, and we like her, but.
I've always wanted to ask you, at what stage did you feel confident enough about what you were doing to say, if someone asked you, I'm a poet?
1968, when I published my first book.
And what was that feeling? What was that like?
That's who I am. And I'm lucky because I was a poor kid. My father's poor. And, you know, we weren't starving or something, but we were poor. And I had enough sense to know, oh, we're poor and they're not. So, you know, you get that. So I knew that I couldn't define myself based on money because I was a poor kid. If I did that, I'd be crazy right. and unhappy with myself. and I didn't want to be either crazy or unhappy with myself. So what I am and what I accrue unto myself, as it were, is two different things. So luckily, I have been able to earn a living with poetry, but I've been just as happy to earn a living dusting. I'm a real good duster. And I live with my grandmother. I am. I'm really, you don't know that, but I am. And when I live with my grandmother, the way that I made spending money, because grandmother and grandpapa were both retired, you know, they didn't have a lot of money either. I mean, we weren't starving, but if I needed something, I needed to find a way to earn a living. I cleaned the house for her friends. But I did such a beautiful job. You know, I was really like, because they only had to do one person's, and I would have the glasses, because they are all a part of the era of segregation. And I have, again, this is something that I don't want to live forever, but I want to be able to write about this, because those black women were club women. All of them were club women. But we didn't have Holiday Inns or Hyatts, or we didn't have restaurants that would let you meet. So all of the women always had to be prepared to have a club meeting in their house. So they had crystal, they had silver, they had, you know, beautiful plates. And so I would go in and arrange the glasses, you know, with the stems and stuff, so that they're top shelves. And I also polished the shelves. And we had a little closet, you know, what do you call it, like a flower closet, where you kept all of that. And I would actually wax the floor, you know. And it was just like really, you know, so I did a good job. And so they would pay me, and then I had some spending money and do something. So if the poetry hadn't paid any money, I would still enjoy reading it and sharing it and doing whatever I could do, but I could also start Nikki's Cleaning Service, and I'd be franchised out, and I'd probably be a lot richer right now.
What, you know, given what you were just talking about, you know, segregation and, you know, the history of our country, how did you feel the night Obama was elected?
I was happy for him, and I am. And I'm a Democrat, and as opposed to, you know, what's his name, McClain. So I had a lot of hope, and I was happy for, as I say, you know, people tried to say or tried to ask, you know, like, do you think Martin Luther King would be happy? I don't know what Martin would be happy about, but Martin wasn't a politician, he was a leader. And I've been just slightly disappointed that this president has not been a leader. He has wanted to be a politician. And when you look at just this thing we're fighting about right now, we're fighting about health care. Well, the exact same votes for health care that he got, he could have had the second day he was in office. And to me, that's what leadership is supposed to be. Just go ahead and do it. And Barack kept trying to make them like him. They're never going to like him. You know, I do not understand. I don't understand how anybody cannot want everybody to have health care. I don't understand it. And, you know, when you consider that poor people take care of rich people, whether it's in the hospital, whether it's handling your Burger King, whatever it is, I do not want people handling my food or my body to be sick. It's so basic. Yep. And so the first thing you want is them to be well. If anybody on earth is well, you want your nurses, your people that take care of your old people, you want them well. So what the hell is this? Let them get their shots or their blood pressure pills or whatever the hell it is, and be happy and well. It just so makes sense to me. The president has not led, because there's probably not five people in the world that can tell you why this bill, the Affordable Care Act, is important. You're for it, but we haven't had the leadership that says this is what we have to do. And now we found out that we're sending drones, which is despicable. You can't kill people with drones. You can't kill people. And so nobody expected the war to be going on in the same way. You can't. And now we realize we're listening in on, that's why anything I have to say, I say it on stage. So somebody says, oh, she's going with a married man. Hell yeah. You know, to hell with the beach. Otherwise, you look around,
speaking,
National Enquirer is doing something.
Speaking of that,
like
you're an active Twitter.
No.
Is that a fake account?
No, I don't do any of that stuff.
Oh, because I looked you up and it seemed like there were a lot of tweets from Nikki Giovanni.
No, not from me. I don't know who's from.
Wow, really? That's
I
funny.
Because
I was actually thinking.
I don't actually know how to. I know. When this book came out, Rachel asked me if I would. I thought it was a blog.
No. No, there are tweets. And what I was thinking how great it was, because basically what's being tweeted out from your account are excerpts from poems, poems. And it's a great way of sending out little passages from your poems.
That's nice.
Yeah. And you have a lot of followers. So
I don't do it.
And learn. I have a special request about the last poem that if you on page 51, sure. I am at that point.
Oh, okay.
A poem I love, and then we're gonna take questions.
Oh, but, certainly. This is a love poem. I love them, though. I am at that point in life when I reread old books, bake my mother's favorite recipes, snuggle with a sneezy quilt, listen to my old rock and roll records, feel comfortable and comforted in my old, nearly ragged bathrobe. I am keeping my house shoes with the holes in the bottom, though I no longer wear them, and yes, the smell is long gone from that bottle of joy, which still sits on my bathroom dresser. Embracing old things is a good new thing, like kissing you again, and not really paying attention to whether or not the Redskins score.
I love that. You worked so many beautiful images and feelings into that one poem, and you got the Redskins in there too.
Well, yeah, and they need to change their name, but
right.
we do watch them. They're going to have to change the name because it's embarrassing now. But no, a lot of this is food and a lot of this is love, and love and food go together because people that you cook for and who cook for you, you know. My son,
we'll take questions.
But Thomas, by the way, is a very good cook. And when my father had a stroke, I moved back home and he moved with me. And Wendy moved also. So now we're in Cincinnati. And there's a lot to do when your father has a stroke. My mother was not going to do well. Ultimately, she's going to have pneumonia and be in the hospital. So I am being a bit overwhelmed. And so I said to Thomas, I think that your responsibility is you have to cook at least one day a week. You can do this. And, of course, that meant my responsibility is to eat it, right? So not a problem. But when Gus came home, and my father never had a son. So Thomas was a great gift to him.
Right.
And so for Father's Day, Thomas said, Mommy, I'm going to cook for Grandpa. I said, fine, that's wonderful. He said, can you take me to the store? Yes. So I took him. I took my hand, you know. He bought it. So he decided he was going to boil a chicken. And I don't know why. And he made his dinner, and he boiled the chicken. He forgot to put the salt in it.
Oh.
So he fixed the chicken, and it really looked pretty, by the way. And he had these vegetables, you know, and we sliced it. And, of course, boiled chicken without salt.
Oh.
It's kind of like cardboard. And the one time that I admired my father, he said to Thomas, it's so nice that you didn't put salt knowing that I was sick.
Oh.
And we ate it. And it really, it's what saved Gus for me. Because it brings tears to my eyes. But that was the sweetest thing he ever said. He would never have said something to Gary or me like that. He wouldn't.
Yeah, I know exactly.
It was the nicest thing because we all had to eat that chicken because Thomas was.
Well,
you know, he knew something was wrong, and so Gus was the one that said, "No, I know you did it for me."
This book is really, really wonderful. It's so filled with, warmth and family and food and feeling and love and lust, and it's it really gives you a sense of who you are. And so, anyway, I've enjoyed getting to talk to you, and I've enjoyed the book. So I think now we have 15 or 20 minutes worth of questions, and we would just ask that when we call on you, stand up and tell us who you are.
My name's Maya. I am 15. I aspire to be a Black historian in my life. I just wanted to know your perspective. I research a lot in the Black nationalist movement, not so much in the Black civil rights movement, because that's covered by teachers already, because they have to have it in curriculum. Anyway, so we know about history so far, but what now makes it important to be Black? We know that there was segregation. We know that there was the Black nationalist movement. We know that Martin Luther King Jr. had the I Had a Dream speech. We know all of these things happened. But now, how is it important for us to
I think it's incredibly important to, one, know history, because to know, I mean, you say Martin's name, and we know that there was a march on Washington, and we're celebrating the 50th anniversary, and we know that, you might not know, but this is the 100th anniversary of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, which was an incredibly important anniversary, because they are the ones who joined the suffragette movement, therefore helping black people get the vote. But you say, what's important about being black? Nothing. What's important about being white? Nothing. It's what we decide to make of what we are and how we decide to bring that together. I don't think that you can say, we know this happened. You know, we have to say, how do we use what has happened? And I think it's kind of important. I'm a history buff, and so the other thing, we're talking about food and love, but even the love poems, there's a lot of history. I'm a big history buff, because we're always learning something new. As we look at the same events, we learn more and more and more about ourselves and about what it is. And a part of, I mentioned it earlier, but a part of the great story of America is not some of the sadness, but how we begin to fight through some of that. So in 1619, for example, a Dutch man of war sailed up the James River and traded 19 Negroes for fresh water. So that already tells you something, like, oh, you know, why didn't they just give them the water and take the Negroes and go on? But no, something says, we want these people here. We don't get the Pilgrims until 1620. So every time somebody white tells me about they're American and I'm not, I don't want to hear it. I was here before. And that's true. And the labor that I put in has helped this country to grow. If we were mature, I wrote a poem in here, Fear, Eat In or Take Out. I think fear should be a spice. And I think that we should wake up in the morning and shake it in our eggs or put it in our fruit mix or do something else with it. Because it's not fear that's the problem, it's hatred. And hatred is easily identified, and it's time that we got rid of hatred.
Giovanni, thank you so much for coming to Northern Michigan. My name is Karen Nemechek. I teach at Petoskey High School. And I have a question about your writing process. At what point do you allow a poem to be finished? At what point do you know a poem is finished and it can take on its own life, whether it's in a book or whether it's on your desk or whether you share it with someone?
Yeah, you know it's finished when you don't have anything to add. But I push things, and so if you're reading any of my work, you see that I can get very, very, very dense, because I go to bump, and then I remember, oh, to bump, and then I remember, oh, to bump, you know, and I keep going around and around. I don't mind doing that. I don't mind putting that on me, because, again, if somebody doesn't like it, what can I do about it? All I can do is my best work, and the woman that I wrote for is dead, and that I wanted my mother to like my work, and so all I do is, and that's why we got Chasing Utopia. All I do is remember the woman I loved. And this is who I want to please. And the rest of us, if you do, I'm happy. And if you don't, I understand. But my job was set out a long time ago. And so I do what I'm supposed to do.
That was Nikki Giovanni at the National Writers Series, talking with Lee Haber. Giovanni is the author of many collections of poetry. Her latest book is called Chasing Utopia. The next program from the National Writers Series features Sarah Paretsky in conversation with Nancy Baker. Paretsky has written 16 crime novels featuring her star protagonist, female private detective V.I. Warshawski. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Milkerrick.